Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ray, and welcome to the RayWenderlich.com podcast. In this podcast, we'll keep you up to date with the latest app development tech talk. Now, here are your hosts, Mick and Jake.
Welcome back to the RayWenderlich.com podcast. Now, usually, this is where I'd introduce the topic for the episode and our guest that's going to be joining us, and then Jake and I would chat for about 10 minutes about what's been happening recently. But all that's going straight out the window today, as we've just finished watching the live stream of Apple's WWDC keynote. So instead of following that usual format, we're just going to bring our guest straight into the conversation and discuss all the announcements Apple just made. So joining Jake and I today is Mr. NS Hipster, Nate Cook. Welcome, Nate.
Thank you.
Before we dive into WWDC announcements, Nate, I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit more about who you are and how you first got involved in iOS development.
Sure. I have been a freelance web and app developer for a long time. Really came into this from the website. Most of my current work these days is in C#, actually, not iOS per se. When Swift came out, I was really inspired to start writing about the language and writing about what was possible with this, as I think a lot of people were. And I've been, you know, just enjoying the process of learning about Swift and how it interacts with iOS and macOS 10 development in these new ways. It's been great.
Okay, I mean, that's a nice little segue into my next question, because I was going to ask you, obviously, you talked then about writing about Swift. And I was going to ask you how you came to take over NS Hipster from Matt Thompson.
He had gotten in touch with a few people to sort of do some writing for NS Hipster as he had some time where he couldn't. And then as he started to need to step back, we kept talking about the site and not wanting it to disappear. And I ended up taking it over sort of as managing editor. So I've been doing the writing since taking over, but going to be opening that up a little more soon and having more of a group of writers covering material as we go forward.
Fantastic. Now, you have one of the more unusual Twitter handles that I've ever seen. Can you sort of explain the backstory behind that, or if there is one?
Well, my name's Nate, and there are 8 N's, so it's sort of like a word game or something. But J.P. Samard stole my joke that it was an increase in repeated consonants in the Twitter handle from Matt to myself. So I was sad to see that go.
Okay. And the final question before we get on to the stuff that's just been announced, we've been asking all our guests recently since they were available. Have you bought an Apple Watch?
I have not. I'm not usually a 1.0 person. So I've been waiting, but this is harder than most products to wait for the next revision. Maybe since watchOS 2 is coming out, I can call that the 2.0 and go for it.
Do you think that's because it's a wearable? Because obviously, as developers, we're like the people that usually would go for the 1.0 because we want to get on that platform immediately and break it apart, pull it apart, and find out what makes it tick. No pun intended. And but because obviously the watch is far more personal and it's something that you probably would intend to wear rather than, you know, just having a phone plugged in on your desk linked to your iMac or whatever. Do you think that's affecting people's decisions? Because I know when we had Nick Lockwood on, he was of the same opinion. And again, you know, he's a developer at Facebook, so you think he'd probably be prime to get that?
Yeah, I think there's a reticence to get something that you'll want to replace so quickly, I think. We can all see that this device is something that has a tremendous potential coming up. It's so much work to get a version 1 of a product out the door. And Apple did an amazing job with this 1.0, but it's clearly still, you know, their first effort at this. And they've learned a lot clearly through the process of getting this one launched. And we'll see that all that progress in version 2. So I think that's a big piece of what's, you know, prompting some people to wait. At the same time, since it's such a personal device, it's, you know, watching other people. You can't surf on an Apple Watch the way you could with a phone and just sort of like get a sense of how it works and what it feels like to use it. If it's not your device, you're really missing out on, I think, what the actual experience of using one is like.
For sure. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. Now, Apple made many announcements, as they usually do at WWDC. But unusually this time, there was very little sort of airtime, if you like, for OS X. But that was the first one that they spoke about, so I think it's only natural that we'll follow their lead and talk about things in the order that they announced them. So OS X, El Capitan. Shall we talk about the name first? I mean, how do people feel about the name? It's unusual.
I think it's great. I think I think it's as close to a snow Yosemite as they could go.
Do you think it infers something about the release? Because it's obviously a very small release.
Right, like a more focused version of Yosemite.
Yeah.
Sort of staying within the confines of the park.
I mean, like I said, I mean, I've made a ton of notes as we went through the keynote, but I've only got, 8 points, including the name for OS X. So I think it's probably not going to take as long to get through these. Natural language processing in Spotlight, that looked pretty cool.
That looks very interesting. And I'm curious about how that API opens up, if they've refined some of the language processing APIs that are already built into Foundation.
I know a big one for you, Jake, was Metal on the desktop.
Yeah, that was one I was really excited about. You and I had a list of the things that when we were trying to figure out what our predictions were going to be for last recording. And I don't think I actually mentioned it, but it was on my list of things that I'd hoped to see. And so I was really happy. I haven't spent much time learning Metal, but I'm a big OpenGL guy. And so I kind of felt like if they move Metal to OS X, I will learn that API, because I feel like then it becomes useful enough for me in my work to have that as part of my kind of repertoire. And even if I didn't learn it, I mean, obviously Metal's a kind of a narrow thing. It's just for graphics, but I mean, anybody that uses a Mac, which is every one of us, is going to enjoy the performance benefits. So I think it's really exciting. I was very happy with that announcement.
So Metal, is that a complete replacement for OpenGL? It's not built on top of OpenGL, is it? It's Apple's own take on that type of architecture.
Yes. Yeah. It's instead of OpenGL, and it reduces some of this the CPU overload. So when the CPU talks to the GPU, the CPU's got to do work to do that. And Metal reduces some of the overhead required. And so they said something like a 30 or 40% decrease in CPU when using Metal over OpenGL for a lot of core animation, a lot of different things that a lot of apps use. So
do you think they're going to... I mean, they'll obviously have to keep OpenGL around in this release just for backwards compatibility with things that haven't been ported to Metal yet. Or maybe they've got some translation layer in between Metal and apps that would use OpenGL.
See, I don't think OpenGL will ever go away, because OpenGL, one of the big benefits of it is it's cross-platform. So, you know, any graphics hardware is going to be able to speak OpenGL. So I think OpenGL will be around for a long time. I don't think it'll go away. If you're doing something for the Mac or for the Mac and iOS, I think Metal becomes a lot more of a benefit. I mean, all the Unity and Unreal Engine and all these things, they're going to support it like immediately. They already do on iOS. So you're going to get that benefit if you're using a third-party tool to do games or whatever. But, you know, if you want to do compute shaders and you want to do GPU stuff, now you can do that on OS X, which I think is a platform that has a lot more candidates for that kind of thing. So,
okay, yeah, great. Yeah,
I'm super excited about that.
Well, I thought you would be, because I know that's right up your street. So the other two big, in inverted quotes, announcements for OS X was an improved mission control. Do you use mission control?
Yeah, I think I do use that a lot for organizing full screen apps, for rearranging them. That's the primary thing I use it for. What they put together looks really good, combined with sort of multi-app full screen, split screen, full screen. What did they call that?
I mean, that the sort of pinning windows to like either side of the screen, I mean, that's something that I remember from like Windows 95.
Yeah, no, but when they first saw that and everybody was like clapping, I was like, welcome to Windows Vista. Like, this is great, but this is not revolutionary. I mean, Apple always gets away with that, where they introduce some feature that's been around on some other platform forever, and in WWDC, everybody goes wild. Like, it's the most amazing thing they've ever seen. So that's normal, but at the same time, I kind of chuckled with that. I was like, I'm glad to have it. I don't. It's a cool feature, but it's...
Well, I just always remember, like, you could right-click on the... Is it called the taskbar at the bottom, where the start menu is, and go tile or windows? And yeah, it would basically do everything that they were showing in the updated mission control, which I thought was quite amusing. And then, obviously, the other sort of big announcement for OS X was a new Notes app. I think that was about it. That's all I got in my notes.
Yeah, they talked about some new, you know, the Safari features. I like the you could kill the music on a tab. That's cool, and that's one of those Apple things where it's like it's an irritating thing that everybody's experienced, and so Apple's like, let's address this and fix it. And it's this nice little feature. It's not, you know, it's not typical Apple move in that it takes something that's annoying that everybody's experienced that no one has really addressed at the browser level and fixes it. You know, I don't know. Maybe there are plugins for Chrome that do that, but I haven't heard about them.
I really appreciate when they do that kind of fix. A lot of times the response of our community is, Chrome already does that, or somebody else already does that, or you just use this plugin. But bringing that kind of annoyance killer to everybody, people who don't have that kind of experience, that means a lot, I think. It adds a lot of value to the customers that aren't techies, that who aren't going to find plugins for Safari.
It was a very... like the use case they gave where, you know, he just opened his fit and he's like, where's the music coming from? Like, that is something that does hit home, I think, would be familiar with a lot of people. I know I've been in that situation quite a few times where you scroll and it's like a little video ad that just immediately starts playing as soon as you load the page. So, yeah, I think that's a nice little touch.
That's great. I don't know. Yeah, those videos always seem like they're timed just long enough that you've moved on from that tab before they start playing.
So we'll move on to iOS 9 because... that was a little bit more, like the features they announced were, there was more of them, which is a good start. So the first thing that they talked about was the proactive assistant. Although I did notice that towards the end of that sort of segment, he started then referring to it as intelligence. So I'm not sure which is the true name. I suppose we'll see that when the marketing pages go up later on today.
Right.
But I mean, this context... sensitive personal assistant sort of next generation Siri. I mean, that looked pretty cool.
Right, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of APIs can feed that proactivity, that intelligence that they're bringing in. If that's something that third-party apps can really supply data to, or if that's primarily going to be Apple's, you know.
Well, I know that they definitely talked about the search API, so feeding into the new Spotlight.
And that's tremendous. Okay. That's going to be a great feature for iOS to be able to search through, you know, app data, since so much of, if you do most of your chatting in WhatsApp or something like that, then you don't have access to any of those messages otherwise.
We'll be interested to see how much did they open this up to developers though, because this, like, me and Jake were chatting on our Slack channel as this was going through, and I don't know if you saw the Google I/O keynote, Nate, but they announced Google Now on Tap, which was very, very similar to this feature, and they opened it right up to developers to feed information into that. So it'll be interesting to see if Apple take a similar approach, or like you say, if they're like keep much tighter control over what can and what can't be presented in there.
Right, I can't wait to get our hands on the new APIs that are coming out.
Yeah, I think we'll all be eagerly watching the State of the Union session, although I'll have to watch it first thing because I think it works out the early hours for me because it's not until the afternoon your time, I think. Yeah. So some of the other stuff that was in iOS 9, again, new Notes app. Big focus on note-taking for this keynote. Improved maps. I was listening to the talk show with Gruber and Mark Gurman. The episode they put out just before, I think, which came out on Friday, and they talked a lot about Apple investing a ton of money in maps, and I think this is the first sign of that. So the next big thing they talked about for iOS 9, and they actually spent quite a fair amount of, like, proportionally on this feature, was the news app.
That looked actually very interesting. We'll have to wait and see what kind of if there are tools that need to go along with that, or if that's sort of automatically converting articles into their format. But that did look quite interesting. A much needed step forward instead of Newsstand, which has basically been abandoned by everyone.
So, I mean, this looks on the surface like Apple's Flipboard or Facebook Articles, each of which have their own custom format that publishers need to put their content in order for it to get into... At least Flipboard, I think, is a little bit more relaxed, but definitely for Facebook articles. And you touched on it then, and Apple did mention the Apple News format quite a few times. So it will be interesting to see if they do give publishers some tools. But one of the questions that kept sort of popping up in my mind as I was watching that segment was, you know, what's in it for publishers? Because obviously the news stand app, you subscribed. So, you know, you were handing over money and getting content in return, but they never once touched on that with the news app.
That's true. It seems like a primarily a user-facing experience, but what are they going to give to developers for it or to publishers for it?
I would be I know Ray will be quite interested in looking to see what's involved in, you know, getting some of our content into the app, because I think that'd be a nice way to read some of the content we put out. But, you know, at the same time, some of our revenue comes through advertising on the site. So if all that stripped out and then there's extra effort to turn what we would publish normally via our own CMS into Apple's format, then they need, you know, like, where's the motivation other than, you know, it's going to look really pretty for the end user. So again, yeah, we'll have to explore that a little bit more.
So we're going to take a quick break and mention our sponsor this week. Instabug is the easiest way for users and testers to report bugs and send feedback directly from within your app. By shaking their iPhone, Instabug will capture a screenshot and allow the user to highlight exactly where the issue is. Instabug also captures all the details you need, such as device, OS, connectivity, console logs, and even tracks the user's steps. So no more guessing or having to ask for more info. You can even automatically integrate Instabug into your existing workflow on GitHub, Bitbucket, Jira, Slack, Trello, Zendesk, and many more. Thousands of apps are already using Instabug to speed up their development process and lower their negative reviews, some by up to 80%. Sign up today at instabug.com for a free account. It's only a single line of code to integrate, so it won't take more than a minute to get up and running. Thanks again to Instabug for sponsoring this episode of the RayWenderlich.com podcast.
They made some big announcements for the iPad, some of which I think has been expected for some time, which was the sort of new multitasking and the dual app, single screen dual app, which looked really nice. And it was also great for developers that they kind of said, if you're using adaptive layout, auto layout, size classes, you know, this stuff's going to work relatively easy for you with little effort on your part, which was great because we've done a big push on the site for adaptive layout and auto layout. I mean, I don't personally use an iPad that often, but I don't know how you guys feel about this.
I think it looks terrific. I think it'll make iPad use more possible for some of the things that I would have used it for in the past, but haven't been, specifically because that kind of going back and forth between two apps is such a inefficient, you know, operation on the iPad. I think it really speaks to how you can look at past WWDCs to see sort of what's coming. They build on the things that they introduce bit by bit. So auto layout, it obviously was you know, meant in part for the different sizes of iPhones coming out shortly after WWDC last year. But you can see it now in the split view and the different sizes that we're going to have going forward.
Yeah, I was excited about it too. It looks, the video, the picture-in-picture thing that they showed was particularly exciting. And I suspect that will be like a special API. It's not just like, you know, if your app plays a full screen video, it just grabs that. I suspect you've got to, like, you know, tell it that there'll be some kind of video player window that you have to play into to make that work. I'm curious to see what the API looks like, and what the limitations are. But I was super excited about that feature, both as a user and as a developer.
Do you feel that something picture in picture, is that something you would use regularly, or do you feel it's more of a gimmick? Because the way I've always seen that kind of stuff is like, a video is something that needs your attention. If you want to follow on what's going along with a video, you need to be watching that video. It's obviously very visual. So if you bring that out of like the full screen environment and put it as they did, like as a little window in the mail, and then you're reading mail, like all you're getting is the sound from that video, which is no different than if that video just continued playing in the background when you switch to mail. So I don't really understand the benefit.
So I might be weird, but I watch TV and stuff all the time. Like when I'm working, when I'm doing other stuff, I always have like a TV show on my second screen. not always, but a lot. So for me, I would use that all the time.
I like to lie to myself and tell myself that I can work while I'm watching something else, but it always, you know, I end up just not getting anything else done.
Yeah, I think I probably lean more towards Nate's camp than your camp, Jack, I'm afraid. I mean, we've spoken before, really.
Whether I'm deluding myself or not, which I acknowledge that's entirely possible, I will use that feature.
Okay, cool. Now, a couple of other things before we move on to watchOS and some of the developer-focused stuff, but that they announced for iOS 9 was the low power mode, which sounds really cool because that can give you up to an extra 3 hours. Reduced over-the-air update size, which then also means that they're not dropping any devices for iOS 9. So you should be able to put iOS 9 on the 4S and up, and I think the original iPad mini and up, which is really cool.
I think.
Well, I mean, I heard in the run-up to WWDC that they've actually changed their approach to supporting older devices now. So whereas before what they used to do is that once the OS update was finished, they would throw it on the old devices and then would start taking things out until they got it running at a reasonable pace. So, you know, like sometimes they'll go, this feature is only available on like the iPhone 5 and up, but you could still get the OS version on the 4S. It would just, some features wouldn't be there. But what they've done this time is they've stripped the OS right back and put that on all the old devices and then added the things in to see. So they've like approached it from the other side, and apparently that's allowed them to optimize it a lot better. So iOS 9 will apparently run even better on the older devices than iOS 8 did, which is, you know, that's obviously a big win for people with older devices as well.
Right. All those things are tied together. So they talked about an extra hour of battery life on the same device when you upgrade from iOS 8 to 9. And that speaks a lot to how much they've been focusing on efficiency and tightening up the existing OS. From a marketing perspective, obviously they are upgrading from 8 to 9, but it really seems like this is also a sort of like a snow iOS update.
So they then moved on to watchOS, which is the official name now for the OS on the watch, obviously, as implied by the name. And this is version 2 that they're announcing, and it's available today. I should say as well that the versions of OS 10 and iOS 9 are also available today. But I think the biggest thing that came out of the watchOS announcement was that they're opening it up to developers to build native apps rather than WatchKit apps. So the logic and the interface runs on the watch. And I'm assuming, although they didn't really go into it, would mean that it's then no longer dependent on the phone.
Was there one slide in there where they talked about the watch having Wi-Fi access independent of the phone?
Yeah. So what they said was, if it goes out of range of Bluetooth, then it will use your known Wi-Fi networks. I assume at some point it'll be synced from the phone to the watch to go onto the network to see if it can find the phone. I mean, this is something that we've talked about before about the watch, because we knew that there was a Wi-Fi capability in there, and we sort of speculated before it was released that whether or not that's what they would use to install apps, like a personal hotspot, like an ad hoc Wi-Fi network, because obviously if you get an app, because they encourage you to put all your assets into the part that gets installed on the watch. So if you've got this huge bundle of images and everything, then you don't really want to be sending that over Bluetooth LE. So I wonder if they've been using this behind the scenes for some time anyway, and now they're just opening it up. Not quite to developers, but sort of widening the use of that functionality.
Yeah, I was real excited about the list of things we could do. Do you know WatchKit pretty well, Mick? It looked to me like most of the example, like they showed the BMW app and a few things like that. It looked to me like they were it's still using a lot of the WatchKit UI stuff, but then it's adding other stuff in. Like some of the animations and stuff look like they wouldn't be possible with our current the Watch SDK, but then a lot of stuff looked like it might still be using it. Do you have any I'm obviously we'll know in a few days when we watch the sessions, but what's your guess in terms of how that's going to look? Is it still going to use an extension, or is it going to just be a completely different binary? What do you think?
I think it probably will still be packaged as an extension. It may be a new extension type. I don't think it'd be still called a WatchKit extension, because one thing that they didn't touch on was whether or not this signals the end of WatchKit. I think WatchKit might still have its place, because WatchKit might become sort of the iOS/WatchOS equivalent to the old dashboard widgets, where, you know, if you just wanted to get something up that was really easy to put together and just showed, you know, a slither of information that was relevant at that time for your app, then, you know, you can stick with WatchKit. If you want to go whole hog, you know, and basically create a fully functional watch-based version of your iOS app, then go native. So I think there is a place for WatchKit. How this is all architected, I'm not sure, because obviously if it's not dependent on an iOS app, then, that would suggest then that it's going to be a different route to installing them. Would it be by the iOS app store? They're going to bring an app store to the watch. What would that look like? So it's all kind of these questions that, you know, these are the kind of things that I thought they would have spent the time on rather than pitching, you know, the new music app. But obviously they didn't feel like this was as important. I mean, we called it on the last episode, Jake. We got custom complications, which is a mouthful, but I'm really happy about that. One thing I did notice as well, on the little slide where they have all the things that come up, there's something called Clock Kit, which they didn't mention, but I'm wondering if we're going to get custom watch faces as well.
Yeah.
Which will be really interesting, because I think that will almost put it on a par with Google Wear and the Google Wear devices, which are obviously a lot more customizable than the Apple Watch.
If nothing else, that's certainly where the complications will live. WatchKit has been so interesting. It's been like a lesson in how you can build an API on something that's so asynchronous. It's almost write only. You can't read the status of controls, things like that. So as we transition to writing for watchOS instead of WatchKit, I think having that direct sort of access to all the controls and events that we've been used to having on iOS and obviously in OS X will be, I think people will find it much, much simpler to write these kinds of apps. I kind of expect WatchKit to go away quite quickly.
Okay, so you don't think there's a place for it to sort of live side by side?
Not as long as, unless it's changed substantially, no, I think it's going to be more or less gone.
So moving on then from watchOS, I'm just conscious of time, I've got about 10 minutes left. I think the biggest thing for developers, at least for the raywenderlich.com crowd, if you like, since we went in with both feet after they announced the original Swift, was the announcement of Swift 2.0.
Absolutely. It looks like there's a lot of new pieces of Swift. It'll be interesting to see the ways that it affects the code we've already written. And obviously, we'll have a lot of revisiting of our past articles, both at NS Hipster and Ray Wenderlich.
Yeah, I think we've got quite a few authors in our Slack channel, and there was some expletives that came out when they announced Swift 2, and it was like, oh, you know, like that's my summer gone this year, because some of those authors contribute to more than one book. So yeah, those guys. And then obviously, I mean, there's going to be brand new stuff that they're going to be want to writing about as well. So it's going to be an interesting summer for sure. But I mean, they look some really good stuff. I just took a screenshot of the slide that they put up, so I could come back down to it.
I'm a bit surprised considering 1.2 didn't come out that long ago.
Well, I mean, they did say that they were sort of moving quickly. They referred to that a couple of times. And also, I think like a point release, like a 2.0 is a much bigger announcement than, say, a 1.3 or a 1.4. So I think it might be just for like PR reasons as well. I mean, again, we won't know the changes until we sort of dive in, we see the sessions, we dive into the docs, we download the beta previews, you know, and we can see what's what. But I mean, there does seem to be some interesting stuff just in that slide. I mean, one of the things that caught my eye was pattern matching in the if statements. I think that's really, really cool. And obviously, markdown in comments. That's a big thing as well, I think. That will help. I think that will encourage people to write better comments.
Yeah, C function pointer APIs is a big deal for people that are still working with like core audio code and other low-level C code. There's certain things you just couldn't do in Swift yet.
Right, that needed an Objective-C wrapper.
Yeah, I mean, I tackled some of this recently with some Cortex stuff and had to leverage the Objective-C runtime to wrap my Swift code in an Objective-C block so that it could call it from pass your function pointers around. So that was really interesting. But yeah, I mean, it would be great if you can get around that. I mean, I did expect to see more. And again, you know, it might be that we do get more, but things like, you know, some of the Cocoa frameworks maybe being ported to Swift. So the way we access them is in a more Swiftified way, if you like, taking full advantage of things like generics and, you know, that kind of thing, rather than, you know, even though we write it in Swift, we still are leveraging all these APIs that are written in Objective-C and therefore have to follow those patterns. And they didn't sort of announce any of that kind of stuff. So I don't know, maybe if they wait until, you know, next year or the year after before they do that.
It's been interesting to watch Swift. It sort of straddles the line between the functional programming camp and the more traditional Objective-C imperative object-oriented sort of orientation. It seems like they're sort of continuing that line where they're not really going toward a true functional programming perspective. They have a new blog post up on the Swift blog about the explaining some of these things that are up here a little bit. And the error handling model, it looks like what they've implemented is a try-catch sort of paradigm instead of what I think the functional people would have been more excited about of like a result as a first class type in the standard library. So it'll be really interesting to see sort of what comes into the standard library that has been developed by the Swift community as like the official way of going forward and writing Swift native code as opposed to just ported Objective-C.
So I think one of the things we should definitely mention, and it kind of just touched on that when you mentioned community there, was obviously announced as well that Swift is going open source. So, you know, this has been open for discussion for quite some time. I know a lot of people, some people were really excited that it could go open source. Others were saying, well, you know, if Apple open sources it, they'll lose some of the control and the direction of the language. And they seem to want to really hold, you know, keep control of that and influence it themselves. Obviously now they have gone open source. So do you think, you know, how do you think that would work? I mean, I know Apple have got some existing open source stuff, most recently HealthKit, but I'm not familiar with sort of how their open source processes work. But I assume it's still a lot more tightly controlled than some of the other open source stuff that we're familiar with.
Right. It'll be interesting to see what license it's released under, if it's under the same that ResearchKit uses, or if it's... you know, what exactly they're doing about, is it possible to fork Swift and have another language based on the work that they've done? I think it's terrific. I think it shows that they're committed to you know, the larger community and having this, the work around it really going forward with the community involved. I think it's great.
When you mentioned there about sort of the error handling model that they've adopted, and it might be different to, you know, the one that the sort of the functional programming crowd would have preferred. It just makes you wonder if, you know, if they are allowed to fork it and commit back, you know, if they were then to implement that themselves and then Apple, you know, I'm just wondering where that would sit with Apple, because obviously they've had some internal discussions about how they feel the language should handle that particular feature. And then the community that actually use it have a very different opinion, and have actually done the work to implement it. Can, you know, do you think Apple would, you know, say, yeah, okay, you know, you are the guys that are using this, and this is what you want, and you've done the hard work. We'll, you know, we'll roll that into the next release. Or do you think it would still be kind of, you can contribute, but you can only contribute in a very small way, in this fashion.
Yeah, they've been very, very open to feedback and very much more, you know, open and responsive than I think we were expecting when we first saw Swift. You know, on Twitter, even, you know, responding to bugs with, you know, that's in progress. That's not something we're happy with. We're working on that. So it'll be interesting to see the way that progresses as people are trying to contribute code back to master. If they're open to taking fixes like they have been with ResearchKit, or if this is more of a just putting the code out there to.
So do you think this is part of like a new strategy from Apple? Because obviously this is a second big thing within, you know, a relatively short space of time that they were open sourcing it.
It does seem like. I think we weren't, given what they've talked about in the past, I wasn't expecting it to be open sourced now. So it seems like they're moving more toward that being their default or their goal for the things that they're building. I think that's great.
Android, like, you watch any of the Google sessions on Android, and Google, you know, will always refer to Android as being open source, and all their frameworks that they provide are open source. And one of the sessions that I was watching, they were talking about some code, and they were like, you know, if you don't quite understand this code, you can just, you know, whatever the keyboard shortcut is in Android Studio, and it will take you to the source code within, like, the Android source code within the SDK. And you can actually see how Google have written whatever function it is that you're calling, or whatever method it is you're calling. So you can get a better understanding of how that piece of code that you're writing that relies on, you know, this internal framework that Google have provided works. And then they've obviously at I.O. announced that they're going full in with CocoaPods. If you want to do any of your iOS stuff, then, you know, they're supporting this, another open source initiative. They've moved all the code from their own Google hosting onto GitHub and are really pushing that. So I'm just wondering if Apple maybe feels a little bit of pressure, because Apple have a much richer community, I would say, based on the experience than Android is, or maybe just more vocal and more willing to contribute. And yet Google's really pushing that from Android, and historically Apple has done very little in that sense.
Right. I think Apple has been, you know, open source when they need to be, when they've been using open source tools originally, like WebKit, probably most famously. But there does seem to be also a, you know, an internal sort of shift of the value system that would lead them to sort of start open sourcing more things. I think it may be a little bit from Google, but Google's, you know, been beating that drum for a long, long time, and this is really the first time we're seeing Apple open sourcing these pieces of their own accord. So I think it comes more from within, and more sort of the direction that the company is shifting to be a little bit more public about the way they do things, and a little bit more reachable and transparent.
Jake, do you have any thoughts on Swift or Apple going open source before we wrap things up?
Yeah, I don't. I'm glad for it, but I guess I thought it was coming. I feel like I saw some stuff by Chris Lattner where he was like, "We can't say what's going to happen, but we're like aware of this idea," and that made me think like it's coming. It's just a question of when, not if.
So maybe you thought it was coming, but maybe not as soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Cool. So as I said, yeah, we'll wrap things up there, guys. It's been great chatting with you both, especially Nate. Thanks for coming on as our guest. Me. Yeah, no problem. That was great. It was great to have you on. And as usual, if you've got any feedback, you can get in touch, podcast@raywenderlich.com. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all next time.
And that's a wrap. Thanks again, everybody, for listening to the raywenderlich.com podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and don't forget to leave a rating on iTunes. See you next time.